Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too this week in the news.
I was just mouthing it. I was just mouthing the intro as you were saying the intro.
3, 2, 1. Hey kids, you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too this week in the news. We talked the passing of Sabu and the lazy river of wrestling criticism, ice cold takes on Backlash and Invader Club. In tribute to Sabu from CyberSlam 96, Sabu versus Too Cold Scorpio, I am Jeff Hawkins. He is business casual Chris Novembrino.
I'm a troublemaker.
A little bit.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a rogue.
We're not even 5 minutes into the show, and I'm starting to get a little cranky.
We didn't even, I got under your skin before we even got on the air this time.
Yeah. Well, did you? You weren't under my skin that much. Okay.
No. I was just talking about the mouthing, the intro thing.
I wasn't even looking at you. I'm looking at my notes.
That hurts.
I just heard you in my ear. Okay, never mind. Me and a couple of the listeners, or the listeners and I, a couple of listeners and I, if we want to be grammatically incorrect, have a bet running, Chris, because we are a bit of a pop culture when things happen podcast.
I love topics. I'm a big fan of topics.
We made a bet, or I actually said, I did not think you would know who Joe Don Baker was. So if I said the name Joe Don Baker, would you know it?
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. He drives monster trucks.
No. Very kind of well-known, at least to me. Character actor was in, let's see. I'll break this down into three categories: movies I know, movies he's known for, and then movies you might know. How about that? Okay. So for me, played the big baddie in a movie called Charlie Varick with Walter Matthau. Also was with Lee Marvin in the Outfit, or not Lee Marvin, Robert Duvall in a movie called The Outfit in the 70s. His first role was actually an uncredited role in Cool Hand Luke. That's a way to start off your career. Best known, perhaps, as top-lining a movie called Walking Tall, which The Rock later remade as Sheriff Buford Pusser. Later roles, if you're in Gen X and whatnot that you might know, if you ever saw Fletch, he's the guy who played the chief of police. He played Jack Black's father in Mars Attacks. He was married to Kathy Bates in that one. If you're a fan of James Bond movies, he was in three of them. He played the rogue general in The Living Daylights, and then later kind of took on the Felix Leiter role in both GoldenEye and I believe The World Is Not Enough. If you are a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, the last episode with Joel Hodgson, they watched a movie called Mitchell. Joe Don Baker was the lead in that. If you saw the remake of Cape Fear, he's the guy who shakes down Robert Duvall at the, or not Robert Duvall, Robert De Niro at the country club.
Wait, is he Jack Wade in GoldenEye?
Yes.
Okay, yes, I do know this man.
Okay, yeah. Big, tall, Texas drawl.
Yep, yeah.
It's very odd to me because it always seems like he's just playing Joe Don Baker in every movie he's in, but he's also awesome as Joe Don Baker. Charlie Varick's an awesome movie, and it's where Quentin Tarantino grabs a lot of his stylistic choices for Reservoir Dogs / Pulp Fiction, I would think, in terms of how he writes criminals and whatnot. But yeah, no, it's just a couple of listeners goes, "You gotta talk some Joe Don Baker this week, Hawkins." I go, "I don't even think Nov knows who Joe Don Baker is."
So. I don't know. So like half credit, I clearly know that he played Jack Wade, and like once you said
knew
that,
the name Jack Wade from GoldenEye. I guess that's from the video game. Was he like a playable character? Okay, I've never played GoldenEye, the video game, because I wasn't an Xbox guy. I was a PlayStation guy.
Well, you would have had to have been an N64 guy to play GoldenEye. Thank you very much.
Well, I had to skip that one. I had the Nintendo, and then I had Sega Genesis, and then I waited a while, and then I had PlayStation 2.
That's nobody had to skip N64. People chose to skip N64.
Well, that was in my early
And you know what? They missed out on the glory and the fully realized genius that was Quest 64. So bully on me for doing that.
Quest 64, is that...
It's like the worst
Zelda?
RPG. No, no. It's this piece of crap RPG that got stopped. Like, they clearly only half-baked it and didn't fully realize the storyline. And they put out basically an incomplete game. It's a
like most games today. No,
yeah, except without the patching. Like,
although, no. I had that happen to me in my first system, the Atari 2600, The Legend of E.T., the video game, of which thousands of copies ended up in a landfill. I think in Arizona or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
There's your pop culture section, kids.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, the other thing, I guess, in pop culture for this week, I have become very intrigued by this show, The Genius Game, which is being made on British TV. It's fun. It is like a reality TV game show where each week a group of competitors are put into kind of logic-based strategy puzzles, and they have to compete against each other in a main game, and then there's a death match for an elimination at the end of the show. I really enjoy it. My partner, she really enjoys it. We have been amused by the fact that The Genius Game is apparently too smart for British audiences, and this has been a common complaint of people, is that, like, I don't understand the games. I don't understand what's going on this show. It's like a weird, like, reading the reviews is almost like a strange form of self-reporting, where, like, basically going on and saying you don't understand this game is kind of just telling on yourself. These games are not that hard to follow.
It's a third world country. What do you want?
So are we, Jeff.
No, that's my bit, is calling England a third world country, and people hate it from England. starting off, yeah, bad news as we woke up Sunday. Sabu, real name Terrence Terry Brunk, which always kills me because they had Terry Brunk and Terry Funk in ECW at the same time.
Passing and yet away we never had the Brunk and Funk connection.
Passing away at age 60. Last match this past WrestleMania weekend at Joey Janela's Spring Break. People really getting on Janela and Brett Lauderdale for allowing him to take a drug called Kratom, or I think that was the name of it.
Really?
To help get through the pain.
I know I'm saying that as I'm smoking a joint, but Kratom is dangerous.
It's an alternative to opioids, and it's legal.
That is true, but it is dangerous, kind of like any of those weird semi-synthetic drugs or whatever. You got to be really leery about them.
I agree, but it's also six weeks after WrestleMania. You can't. There were people asking for them to get indicted on involuntary manslaughter and stuff like that. I'm like, I don't think the drug
golly.
Lasts that long.
in the case of Terry Brunk, that's going to be a collective lawsuit, a collective action lawsuit, if you're going to get everyone who's ever given him a drug.
That's true, too. this is where I think my place in wrestling podcasting is a positive. There's not a lot of people who will say that, but I will right now, because I was there and online in that 1994 to 1996 time period when ECW became ECW. And I was doing some research today, and interestingly enough, Dave Meltzer's first ECW show was my first ECW show, and only ECW show at the ECW arena, called Double Tables. And I need to kind of set the story, because I think it's one of these weird things where people don't understand the legend of Sabu, really. There's an independent promoter from Michigan who goes, no, he has a big deal. And I get that. He was a big deal in Michigan. But him becoming the thing, like this thing of legend and stuff like that, is almost purely a creation of the internet. And so I'm going to read something from the week after's Wrestling Observer, and talk about it, because if you get into things like, man, Dave Meltzer sucks, but Sean Ross Sapp is cool, or man, Dave Meltzer's cool, but Sean Ross Sapp sucks, a lot of that comes from this trip that Dave Meltzer made to the ECW arena and how it lived rent-free in Dave Scherer, who I believe works for, what is it, Pro Wrestling, was it Pro Wrestling Net? I believe he now works for. He started the Wrestling Lariat and then later won Wrestling News on the basis of Dave Meltzer living rent-free in his head. So let's go with this then. February 13th, 1995. The most talked about smaller promotion in the world is without a doubt the Philadelphia-based Extreme Championship Wrestling. The ironies are many. ECW is a group that has never drawn much more than 1,000 to any show in its history. Yet it is one of two American promotions to be invited to the multi-promotion Tokyo Dome show. It finished third for best promotion and won best television show in the Observer balloting. Among its relatively small core of fans are people who regularly drive hundreds of miles to the converted bingo hall for its major show each month. The irony doesn't end there. Promoters involved with much larger organizations, such as Eric Bischoff this past weekend with WCW, in parentheses, when plugging the pay-per-view in Baltimore and worldwide, noted they're running the Baltimore Arena and not a bingo hall, and Ron Scholar are clearly bothered with the attention ECW receives. ECW is talked of as being the best wrestling in the United States, and among groups that regularly run house shows, it probably delivers the best house show product. An asterisk has to be put by that statement when comparisons are made with other groups, because judging from the physical punishment many of the guys take, they couldn't possibly work at that level if they were doing four or five shows a week and survive very long. Despite not having six-figure contracts, it has two of the four most exciting performers that work regularly in the United States as regulars on top in Sabu and Chris Benoit. Now, in his review of the show, Dave then later says, quote, the matches were good, but not as good as he was led to believe. And this is where Dave Scherer and his guys, who are some of the guys who were driving hundreds of miles to the converted bingo hall for the monthly shows of ECW and propping this up on bulletin boards like Rec Sport Pro Wrestling and Prodigy and AOL and CompuServe, lost their stuff. Look, Sabu had a match with Sean Waltman, who was then the Lightning Kid in 1993. But the reports of the house shows all in ECW were like this party atmosphere that you had to be at. The only modern equivalent, I would say, is when Pro Wrestling Guerrilla got really hot, and you have to come to Reseda to watch this show in the VFW hall or the American Legion hall or whatever. I forget what it was. It was a VFW hall or whatever. It was that kind of thing. And it was like, oh man, Sabu, he had this match. And then afterwards he moonsaulted through a table, you know, not on a guy, just did it to break the table. And so, and he popped the crowd. It's amazing. Oh, you got to see these guys called Public Enemy, because their act live is so awesome. And then what turned out is that Dave Meltzer kind of correct, because he goes for, I mean, because basically his point was, well, for the audience here who loves ECW and stuff like that, they love this, but I don't think this will translate to another company or whatever. And then it turned out that ECW, led by Sabu, ended up changing both WCW and WWF. Both adapted the hardcore wrestling style. Both both signed Sabu eventually. Like, Sabu had a cup of coffee in WCW when everybody was being signed, lasted, I think, 2 weeks, and then turned up on the ECW invasion of WWF later. But, I mean, and that was Sabu also to a nutshell. I do all this preamble, then start talking about Sabu, who ECW and their fans had a love-hate relationship with, because he was of the Carney crew in many, many ways. He was a guy who's like, oh, no, wrestling shouldn't look smooth all the time because it's supposed to be a real fight. Like, if you want to hear a great story, go listen to Monday's Wrestling Observer Live with Lance Storm, where Sabu is angry at the fans for knowing his moves and yelling, you fucked up, pardon my French, when they'd mess up a move or whatever. So he tells Lance Storm, hey, do this move, I'll do this move, and I'll purposely mess it up. And then the fans start chanting, you know, you effed up, you effed up. And Sabu's laughing on the mat going, ha ha ha, got him. He'd no-show big ECW shows for a bigger paycheck. And then Paulie would come out and join the fans in running down Sabu and what a horrible person he was, blah, blah, blah. And then 2 months later, Sabu would be right back at ECW and all be forgiven doing whatnot. Yeah, I mean, look, early Sabu was a revelation in so many ways because nobody had seen that kind of stuff before, unless they were following Japanese wrestling. But even Japanese wrestling changed because of the hardcore nature of ECW and getting frontier martial arts wrestling and all that other stuff in there, and war and all those other promotions that did the Japanese hardcore style that we're used to now. You know, WWF and WCW were such garbage at this time. You know, WWF, their WrestleMania push was the Lawrence Taylor Bam Bigelow WrestleMania event and stuff like that. And so people were looking for alternatives, and where they were finding it is if they could find tapes of like All Japan and All Japan Women and New Japan, they get them. But stateside, the two hot commodities, at least 93, 94, 95, were Smoky Mountain Wrestling and ECW. And ECW would always make news by doing something that pissed somebody off. The night the line was crossed, infamous for pissing off the old school NWA guys because they had an agreement there, etc. And Sabu was a part of this. I mean, Sabu would piss off ECW people just to piss off ECW people. Later years did stints in, you know, in TNA that, you know, had matches with like the likes of Abyss and company that were hardcore and great. But yeah, as the years went on and he kept doing the hardcore stuff, the body started to break down. I remember seeing him at in Dallas at the WWN stuff out there, because like Terry Funk was there like that. Terry Funk loved the guy, by the way. Terry Funk and Dave Meltzer was talking about this on the phone on Sunday night. Terry Funk wants Sabu in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame because of his influence on the business, because of the hardcore style and what that translates to, and how Terry Funk looked up to Sabu as a guy he needed to keep up with to do the style that was popular today. I've talked a lot here, Chris. I'll let you give some thoughts on Sabu, and then I'll continue on whatever I think of.
Yeah, so to start off with Dallas, I got to meet him and his partner slash
right.
the genie briefly.
Yes. Yes.
At the WWN show near where the barbecue stands were. Behind those double doors, I got.
By the way, again, we have to say best catering of any wrestling event I've ever been.
Oh my god, just so good, like good food.
Yes.
You know, I also, for me, ECW was the hard to find alternative, and like, you know, much of what you said rings very true for me. Although being younger. My experience was occasionally DirecTV would run an ECW show on DirecTV's free side. And I got turned on to ECW by just discovering it on DirecTV. I must have
seen. Well, before you continue, let me ask, what was your let's say peak ECW years. Was it like TNN years or was
No, it would have been before that. Yeah, it would have been prior to that. So like they got on TNN, I don't know, like a year 99. So it would have been like 96, 97 that I was watching ECW.
Okay.
And so like I saw many, many, many Rob Van Dam and Sabu matches during that period of time, whether they were in a tag team or it was them, you know, single. Like for me, the company was really built around Rob Van Dam and Sabu, you know, Taz as well. Taz was the champion, and so was Shane Douglas. Shane Douglas first, and then Taz. So that would have been my vintage of ECW.
Okay, I'll give you my framing. Once Rob Van Dam came in, I was kind of on the downslope of my ECW fandom. I was in that early 94 to 90, early 97, you know, when you had the Luchadors coming in, and you had, you know, you still had Benoit and Malenko, and it was kind of like the way station for guys going in between WCW and WWF. I saw the Steve Austin stuff. You know, Ron Simmons was there when I first started watching. Matt Bourne was there for a cup of coffee doing Bourne Again, the angry doink gimmick and stuff. But yeah, continue. Sorry.
So that was sort of my experience with Sabu. I, you know, would be watching him in 97, 98. And you know, Rob Van Dam, in particular was cool to me. I was a new young stoner. So, you know, guy wrestler who smoked a lot of pot very much appealed to me at 16 years old. As I'm up at midnight watching ECW on DirecTV stoned out of my mind. So, and then like Sabu, look, I'm watching our Vader Club match too as we're doing this, and you know, this is probably like early Sabu, there's some actual like decent work, but like as his body broke down more and more, he was just compensating by killing his body more and more. My analysis. It's like, rather than focusing on some of the stuff that he's doing in this match, which is, yeah, a lot of hardcore stuff, but like also victory rolls and other things, it's like he instead was like, no, it's easier to just go through a table. And I'm like, is it? So it's unclear to me that going through more tables is the answer that you're looking for, Mr. Sabu. I think him, Alfonso, and Rob Van Dam epitomized the energy that Heyman wanted out of this company, like a chaotic, countercultural, youthful sort of thing. Even though Sabu's not youthful, like the hardcore style and like the recklessness of Sabu paired with Rob Van Dam, like the weird buddy comedy thing, like that really felt like what Heyman wanted. So Heyman fighting with Sabu was always attention you didn't really believe, because like, what is this company without Sabu? And that only became more true with Raven gone too. Like I was starting to watch right at the end of like the Raymond Dreamer stuff, and then Raven ended up over in WCW.
Yeah, it kind of became a switching partner thing with Sabu, because originally, like in my time, it was him and Taz, which, you know, was also the main event of that double tables, was him and Taz versus Benoit and Malenko. And then as Taz kind of switched over to being a single star, and he kind of gets, you know, he gets rebranded when after he gets injured, his neck gets injured as Taz, and then he becomes, you know, the
suplex machine.
Human suplex machine, doing the MMA gimmick, the Team Taz stuff. All that. And then eventually, you know, they bring in Rob Van Dam, and becomes the whole frenemies thing, where it's like, we'll have them team until they hate each other, and then they'll feud with each other, and then we'll have them team again, you know, to get the love back from the crowd. You're so right in terms of how it's so weird now thinking about it, is how the energy of the crowd was all dependent on how they felt about Sabu at the time, kind of a thing.
And I always felt like those Rob Van Dam and Sabu matches, even though they were not necessarily the main event of the show, they were usually like the sub-main event or whatever, they're kind of the heart of the show. Like, if those matches clicked – the rest of the show kind of clicked. And if those matches didn't click, the rest of the show didn't.
I still have Paul Heyman coming out to begin a show by turning the entire crowd on Sabu, who wasn't there that night. And just the level of vitriol that was brought on by that. And then he riles up the crowd to get this angry. And then there's like a couple of surprises in the show to make them happy again. But this, like the emotional core of ECW, like don't give me, you know, Dreamer's great. Raven's great. Taz is great. You know, they're all like that. But really, when you think the ebbs and flows of emotion, how people felt about ECW, it's usually how they felt about Sabu at the time. Because, like, even towards the end, they're just like, all Sabu is doing is going through tables and doing sloppy hardcore, et cetera, et cetera. But in the early days, he was a god to people. And it's just one of those interesting time capsule things that I got to live through. Do you have a favorite Sabu match? Because I'm assuming probably the RVD versus Jinsei Shinzaki match.
Yeah, I really do. I really like that. I mean, that being said, this week's Vader Club is probably his best worked match.
I would say that too.
He does it. He's really, you know, you just see a diversity of moves and stuff in this match. I mean, not just from Scorpio, but Sabu himself. That requires him to work much deeper. I don't know if this is his best match, but I feel like this is the best match that I've seen him in.
Follow-up question. Do you remember your first sighting of Sabu?
It's him and Van Damme, and it's not Jinsei Shinzaki and Hayabusa. It is, oh God, they're facing...
Gato and Gato?
No. No, but it's one of those like summer pay-per-views in like 97 or whatever. They're it's a tag match.
Let me see. I'll look it up real quick. Or yeah, look it up.
I
talk about mine.
That's true. Let me look it up.
I remember I came home from college and there was a local channel that basically played all the wrestling. You know, one day a week or whatever. And they had ECW, and I was so excited because I had only heard about this on the internet. And I saw, and they were playing highlights, or actually, they called it highlights, but it was actually the entire match, I think, of it was Sabu versus Cactus Jack. And the one thing that lives rent-free in my head was just, this is when Cactus Jack was an absolute maniac. And so they take a real beer bottle, and Sabu hits him in the head, and you just hear the thud. Like, that's no good. And so Cactus Jack makes him do it again, and it finally breaks. Or I think he hits him like three or four times. This is like, I think this is the one where he actually uses, he goes to the back because I think he's torn his tricep, and he tapes it up with electrical tape or something so he can keep going in the match or something. It's just, it's one of the most insane things I've ever seen. I might be melding my memories of it, but do you have the answer?
I'm pretty sure it's Dreamer and Sandman.
Okay, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I'm looking the two. It's I don't think it was the Eliminators, and I don't think it was the other match that they had that year. I'm pretty sure
What was the other
Kikuchi
match
Kikuchi and Ogawa?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't ring a bell. I'm thinking it was Dreamer and Sandman.
Yeah. I thought all the companies that gave tributes, that gave nice tributes. I was especially a little broken up by Taz talking about him on AEW television. That was nice. And WWE gave, you know, Michael Cole gave Taz a shout out on TV, which is nice.
Yeah, I thought that was real cool. Like, yeah. Michael Cole giving Taz a shout out. I thought that was sweet.
Yeah, turns out the only guy who hates the other company is Ricochet and probably Will Ospreay.
I gotta tell you, I mean, it's almost like there's a morality lesson here that hate is stupid and you're better to have a more enlightened, nuanced approach to most things.
Sad news, Jim Ross via social media this week announcing he's fighting colon cancer. Look, as a guy who's fighting inside cancer himself, all love and prayer to Jim Ross, man. I think he'll probably be off TV for while this is happening, but he may show up once or twice. So I'll give him mad respect if he does, and not comment on the bad things about Jim Ross, because
I have plenty of
criticism of Jim Ross, and now's not the time. Just give him good vibes and everything.
And let him enjoy his time on TV.
Yeah. I gotta be maybe less critical of Jim Ross sometimes.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm totally down with having him have an appearance now,
yeah,
given the news, but I don't necessarily think that retroactively justifies having I can't work backwards.
A Multnomah County judge Wednesday ordered William Albert Haynes, a.k.a. Billy Jack Haynes, to be sent to the Oregon State Hospital, ruling he is unfit to assist in his own defense, KATU News in Portland wrote. Copy of the order signed by Judge Angela Cerro cites a report by a certified evaluator that looked at Haynes' behavior at the hearing, statements from his attorneys, and stipulations from both the defense and prosecutor stating that he is unfit. If you've seen this season's Dark Side of the Ring with Billy Jack Haynes, yeah, that's probably a good call. That episode, pure carny from Billy Jack and whatever lucidness he still has left. He says that he killed her to get rid of Alzheimer's and stuff like that, but he is obviously also suffering from some conditions there too. Any thoughts before I move on?
Not really.
This is a heavy one, so let's go to other things. Wednesday night's special beach break edition of AEW Dynamite averaged 682,000 viewers on TBS, an 8.4% increase from last week. It's the best audience total the show has done since September 8th of 18th of last year. Yes, and here comes the asterisk of those legions of max viewers that apparently exist too. So it might have been an even better number than that. But just before we go into the Lazy River, real quick, what do you think of Dynamite this week? Do you think that merited the bigger audience? Because I thought they did a lot of good stuff on there.
I mean, a lot of good stuff. I
their builds to me are still weird. So
right, the builds to me. You were asking me, am I gonna go to the show here in Albuquerque? And like my response was,
nope.
You're like, it's a go home show, and I'm like, no. And I'm
it's
like,
an emphatic no from you. As a matter of fact, no, I'm not going.
Hell no. You don't know. Yeah, I mean, I that's true, but you just don't know what you're gonna get. I think that's gonna be the issue. I look at this as easy come, easy go. If this holds for a month, I'll say something about it, but I have no faith that things are gonna be any different next week.
Yeah, that's true. Former Impossible Future Dave, WWE wrestler Nikki Bella, aka Nikki Garcia, will have to pay her ex-husband child support as part of their final divorce settlement that includes her gaining trust in her business ventures, reported by TMZ on Friday. November 2024 agreement recently signed off on by a judge has the former Nikki Bella and ex-husband Arden Chigvintsev, I believe is how you say the name, coming to an agreement that will see her pay him $3,500 a month in addition to $200,000 in total before the end of the year. Get paid, I guess. I just remember he got arrested for battery, I thought.
That's all I can tell you is it must be a damning indictment on Nikki Bella based off of that previous context.
No, I think this is they went into business together, and in order to gain points on the business for future...
She's going
to
pay child support?
Well, she's going to pay the $200,000. $3,500 a month... I'm a dancer, and I'm no longer on Dancing with the Stars because I got arrested for slapping you around, allegedly. How am I going to pay for our son's orthodontics? I don't know.
There's something wrong here, but I'll tell you, the picture does at least at first blush, from where I'm sitting, does not look great for Nikki Bella.
I mean, I've been involved with guys who are in family court, and good dads can't get anything judges.
I know. Normally, it takes. I mean, it depends on
and
your state or whatever.
Her
but
or
in
whatever.
In many states, the result that she's paying him means strange and bad things have occurred.
Good Lord. I don't want to go into my friend's family court issues, but
no. And I can't speculate beyond that either, but it certainly makes me raise an eyebrow because it's so contra to the way these stories normally go, especially given the fact that this guy has
police involved in this thing.
That this guy has some question marks over his head. This just, for me, puts some large ones over her.
We'll end there and go into the lazy river of wrestling criticism, whatever we watched, whatever we had time for as we went off the air last week. Pat McAfee and Gunther was starting. And we both had very positive opinions of that match, Chris, especially you.
Yeah, I just thought it was everything I kind of want out of wrestling, which is not necessarily an intensity of work or a crispness of work or even a five-star classic. It's like to actually have emotional beats in a match that matter and kind of keep raising the drama. And I thought, for me, Michael Cole getting off the headset and going down ringside, motivating Pat, even interfering and trying his damnedest to get Pat to get the win, I found that to be poignant and effective. And to the point that you and I were both kind of like mocking Wade Barrett for standing on the sidelines as Michael Cole was in peril. I mean, I thought that, you know, the Cole beat was so strong that it made
there,
Wade
you
Barrett,
coward.
Yeah, made Wade Barrett, former professional wrestler, guy who has challenged John Cena, seem like an absolute wimp when, you know, McAfee, part-time wrestler, Cole, never wrestler, Wade, retired former full-time wrestler who's contended for major titles.
Nigel McGuinness standing up for his partner.
Yeah.
You know,
so,
against FDR, you know, where are you, Wade Barrett? You coward, you chicken. Christopher Vambrino said that, not me. Okay.
I did say that. I want Wade roasted much more regularly. I for my part, especially when we got back to like Jey Uso and everything, I'm like, man, it really does feel like the temperature got turned down on the Gunther storyline, unfortunately. Because I weirdly, there's more intrigue here with him feuding with Pat McAfee and Michael Cole than there is with him feuding with Jey Uso. And that certainly indicates to me that something's wrong with the Jey Uso picture. Like, he doesn't have I crowd command, unbelievable, right?
Yes.
Like the crowd command.
But once the yeeting stops.
Dude, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, and then some days it's like there's nothing to eat and you go hungry.
What are you doing? Puns
I'm killing it.
This show.
I'm killing it. I'm bringing back radio
I am so happy that somebody else in with a bigger voice and more listeners, unfortunately, finally picked up on my pet peeve about Becky Lynch. And that's Brian Alvarez. The Becky Lynch, she kicked out at 2 frustration spot. Is the worst thing in wrestling right now for me. The holding her head, biting the finger, holding her head again, furrowed brow, you know, kind of the covering her eyes type of thing. What do I do now?
But I did perfect math. My math
but
was
I did
perfect.
Math. Yes, I did all the calculations.
I did math.
Wrong.
This should have worked.
The elephant lamp should have worked. Now I have a flare gun in my locker and I'm going to kill myself. And that's why I'm in detention. Breakfast Club reference. Yeah, I think it drives me nuts. It's so weird for someone who has actual acting training that Becky is such a horrible actress when she tries to act. Because this also came into her promo on Monday, which I found dreadful. I'm sorry. Becky as a heel. Blaming the fans. No.
I'm so sick of blame the fans. I thought blame the fans is bad writing.
Blame the fans works when the fans can be to blame. Like Mick Foley playing the hardcore, getting rid of the hardcore icon stuff in ECW was a good blame the fans promo, you know?
Problem with blame the fans is you can't have a match with the fans.
True.
So the fans aren't a character. You can't carry on history and beef with the fans like that. Or, I mean, I guess you can, but, you know, if you're a heel.
No, this is a great point, and this is Occam's razor. Come back to bite people right here.
Yeah, right? So
how do you build that feud against the fans? Do you come out again and go, oh, you're all a bunch of fat losers with no jobs? Like,
you introduce a Santino Marella type character and just start beating the shit out of him only for us to discover he's a wrestler?
Yes, yes.
They've done that before, too. Right? And typically what we end up doing, like our way out, right? I'm sure someone's yelling this at their radio, is like, well, you know, Chris, normally someone comes out and they're the surrogate for the fans. I'm like, yeah. And sometimes that connects with the fans and sometimes it doesn't. But
that becomes impersonal because it's about fighting for the love of a fickle audience and the what that baby face it. Like if Bailey came out as the voice of the fans right now and she's not Hugger Bailey.
Oh my God. And like, let's also get into this. The voice of the fans promo always sucks and it sucks ass every single time. These people are the reason we are here. I love working for these people every week. I love looking at the children. I love seeing them smiling. I love the happy fathers who are appreciated. I love going to Paducah, Wisconsin. I love going to Albuquerque, New Mexico. I love going to Des Moines, Iowa. I love going to Billings, Montana. And working.
If it wasn't for these people in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, we wouldn't be getting a paycheck this week, sir.
I love this town so much, I know it's pronounced Wilkes-Barre. Yes. That's how into Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania I am. I love the fans. And I look at you and you disgust me for wanting personal accolade in a company centered around belts that can only be worn by one person at a time. I'm sickened by your want to be in a main event when you should just be thrilled to be out here and making people smile in a six-man tag with Natalya.
Why do these promos suck, Jeff?
You tell me.
Oh, God. Wilkes-Barre is always the audience where they do the most half-assed thing, and then they wonder why the fans turn on it. It's one of those things. Here in Hershey, we don't stand for that kind of stuff. Oh, God, yes. Just make personal issues draw money, kids, and not just the...
A passionate love of Chevy Chase, Maryland does not.
Or Chevy Chase in general.
Passionate love of Chevy Chase ain't going to win you any fans either.
Well, this week CNN came out with a PR blast that they're doing a documentary on Chevy Chase. And they asked Chevy Chase what he thought of that. He goes, I hope to learn something about myself by watching it.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple $1,000s in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/affirmations or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/affirmations.
God, dude.
Oh, yeah, no.
What do you want me to say other than mild horror? I hope you don't do too good of a job.
The four-way, I think we went over during the show because I had watched it. I thought it was solid. Orton Cena, on the other hand.
The complete wrong match.
Yes.
Like, this heel run of John Cena stinks, and this Orton
Although,
match...
he is ruining pro wrestling for...
In a way, yes. By going out there and having the exact same turd match he always has with Randy Orton, they've always stunk. They've always been 2.5 stars for me every single time, because there's just not enough between these two guys to make it interesting. And this was such a great opportunity to do a different match, and the match was so simple. It was sitting right in front of you. We're in St. Louis. Randy Orton, now a living legend. Finally, John Cena can invert the legend killer thing on Randy Orton. John Cena should have came out there, and basically Randy is like our Apollo Creed type figure. He's out there, and they're all like, RKO, RKO, and he's kind of like playing to the fans, and he's even a little bit like, I got this. This is going to be easy for me. Like, John Cena's washed. I'm big. I'm strong. I'm looking awesome. And Cena comes out there, and what do we get? Ruthless aggression. We get ruthless aggression in front of a St. Louis audience, and we see Randy Orton, a legend, killed in front of his hometown crowd, and we send him powdering. We don't see Randy Orton again. John Cena's not just here to beat Randy Orton. John Cena is here to hurt Randy Orton. John Cena is here to hurt the fans. The fans he's supposedly at war with. If you are at war with the fans, if this is indeed the story you've committed to tell, this kind of crap story, then you have an awesome opportunity with the hero, hometown hero of the fans, living legend, perhaps the most popular wrestler in that 45 range right now, Randy Orton. You kill him. You murder him in front of his crowd, metaphorically, of course, and you do this and you revel in it. No, Jeff, no one's brave enough to have the Novembrino gun match yet. And maybe John Cena will finally break that frontier.
No, I was about to say thanks, James Comey, for clearing out that you were being literal about this.
Yes, no. If you want later, you can analyze deeply.
Can we get
86
no, no,
I love the idea of analyzing numbers. By the people who are analyzing those numbers. What does 8-8 mean is all I'm going to say. If you're telling me what 8-6 means, tell me what 8-8 means.
No.
But that's a whole different thing.
You know what? I like that idea, but I'll add this too. I would have had Bob Orton there. I would have had John Cena go, hey, legend killer, going to kill your legend right now.
Boom. Right. Yeah. Right, do it in front of Bob. Really twist the knife here. This is a guy who his disdain for the fans, if you're going to make that the story, because you don't have Rock anymore in the mix.
Well, it's a story you're telling. You might as well tell the story.
Then tell the story, right? And this match did nothing. The match they gave us, the same John Cena-Randy Orton match, only with babyface and heel flipped around intentionally this time, as opposed to when the crowd just is sick of John Cena and they're cheering for Randy Orton, ironically, in the past, 10, 15 years ago. This match was the wrong match. It did nothing to advance this I hate the fans thing.
And I hated the – look, I understand why they did it. And this match was even more so – God, I might say Stone Cold versus somebody, where Stone Cold wasn't going to win the title, but everybody wanted to see stunners. So we bring out all the goobers from the back office who used to be workers and give them all RKOs. Type of a thing. Don't get me wrong, it made the fans pop, but
is that really what we needed to have happen? Did we really need to pop the fans? I think this should have.
No, we want heat with the fans because this is his hometown. And hey, yeah, I know everybody makes the joke, oh, guys always lose in their hometown because it's Vince. But this is the one time where you're telling the story that John Cena is going to kill the legacy of the Ortons in St. Louis.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. This is a guy who wants to retire the belt. He wants to add things. I mean, right down to him getting hit with the beer bottle this week. This whole thing's supposed to be about him hating the fans now. Then make them hate you, dumbass.
Yeah, they're doing this God, it's a lot like.
And then at the end, off air, where he's like looking at the crowd and he's wistful. I don't want that shit at all. I don't want wistful bullshit. I want joy. I want a guy who's.
I'm happy that you're upset at me.
Like, I'm having an effing good time doing this.
Yes,
like,
because he is.
Right
said,
now, he should be marinating in this shit. He shouldn't be wistful.
It's the whole thing where I'm going to take away pro wrestling from you, and there was no regret from it.
I'm stealing Christmas, and it rules.
Yes,
this is an effing blast. I'm having a good time right now.
Oh, you're not having a good time? That makes me even happier.
If
that,
anything,
that kind of thing. Yeah.
And I'm surprised at how much fun, like really, like he should actually be surprised at how fun this is.
I never knew life could be like this. I thought
I was going to be more conflicted, but honestly, this is very clear for me right now. And that is enjoyable. I'm having clarity.
Yes.
Like, yes.
What they're doing is they're trying to set up the redemption, and they shouldn't be doing that yet.
Not right now. No.
No, the redemption comes when a bigger force of evil comes over John Cena and knocks him back into reality that he wasn't the big bad he thought he was all along, and that's The Rock, of course.
Right.
And whatever.
Honestly, The Rock coming back in and maybe reminding John Cena. See, this is the
Hopefully
thing.
Hopefully with Braun Breaker spearing him half to death.
Right. Like, if Cena was really enjoying himself and power tripping on this, it would make Rock coming back in and reminding him he's just a puppet that much more of a poignant beat. Right. You know, this would go such a long way of like, no, John, like, I get it. And the St. Louis is fun. I enjoy it. Up in the office. We enjoyed watching what you did in St. Louis. You made all those people very upset. But I need to remind you something. You're my champion. And when Cody Rhodes wouldn't be that champion, I needed you to be that champion. So now let me remind you of what the game plan is here, John, and what the big picture is here, John. No, if John Cena was power tripping, thinking that, like, hey, you know what? This is the best hell run I've ever had. I am kind of turning into a little bit of a renewed god of sorts.
Like if he
and
starts,
then he's reminded
like getting,
that he's a puppet.
Like if he starts getting really big headed, I'll take anybody on right now. I'll take Stone Cold. I'll take Ric Flair. I'll take Hulk Hogan. I'll take on The Rock right now. Ooh, you know, that kind of thing where it's like he believes in his own legend. And then it's time to knock him down.
Actually, to that point, he's not even. I'll take on anyone. He just talks about how he is the
greatest
better.
I'm better than Bruno. I'm better than Stone Cold.
Stone Cold couldn't last. Rock walked away. Yeah, Bruno didn't draw like I did. You know, whatever it's gonna be. You know, Bob
Hogan.
Hogan. Yeah. Where's Hogan? Yeah, Hogan. Everyone just starts booing. Enough said. Need I say more? Is a great champion. Someone you're booing on the back end. Like, you know, that sort of thing. Like, you know, and then, you know, just basically run them all down and go like, look, who is it beyond me? Daniel Bryan, you know, well, a 1 year flash in the pan, Kofi Kingston, your 1 year flash in the pan. You tried to find Cena alternatives and you failed. I am the great one. That sort of thing. They're just doing, this could be good. It's not. But it could be good.
It could be. Also, what could be good but isn't right now, and I hate to say this because I really did enjoy the main event from Raw. We're already breaking up Roxanne Perez and Julia on social media.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt like that was going to be hard to keep Julia heel, I think, after the NXT performance, because I think at least in the NXT stadium, she's going to be received as somewhat of a baby face. You know, she's going to be at worst a tweener over there.
But last television win for Roxanne Perez, by the way. Friday Night SmackDown, February 28th, 2025. They've just been killing her. On Monday Night Raw, on NXT, on Stand and Deliver, on Raw, 3 weeks in a row, she's lost. 2 weeks in a row. It's going to be...
Former top champion from NXT.
Person they like. They no, like her
no,
a
but
lot.
I, what I'm going to say is former top champion from NXT is a very tough position in this company. It is not always a guarantee. Sometimes you're Braun Breaker. Sometimes you're Carmelo Hayes. The runway is not as clear as it looks.
And again, undersized and looks like they're going to be bringing some people up. She might get lost in the shuffle here. That's my fear. I mean, it's one of those, well, we've seen what she can do. And we've beat her a lot. How do we make her a star? How do we rebrand her? And then they're just kind of flummoxed. That's my fear here. Like, there are people they bring up too early. Like Kiana James, who I think she's almost ready to come back after her rehab. But and then they figure out we don't know what to do with her. Roxanne Perez, the game plan was obvious, is you need to turn her babyface before bringing her back up to the main roster or reemerge her as a babyface on the main roster in her debut. And now it's going to be hard, I think. I mean, maybe Julia can murder death her to the point where people don't like Julia, but people like Julia because she's an ass kicker.
It might actually be a more graceful transition to turn them both babyface.
Yeah. She should turn Rhea heel.
I want to stop on Rhea real quickly here. Because okay. Rhea boring. Rhea boring ever since Judgment Day. She ain't got no Judgment Day. She ain't got no nothing.
She's very dull.
Dull.
I will agree there.
She looks great. No, I get it. Rhea Ripley looks awesome. I like looking at Rhea Ripley. That's cool and all. What does she do? What's her character? I mean, no, she used to be in the Judgment Day last year, but like that was like almost 9 months ago. So like what's she been doing since then? Not much. She has the TT thing still on. When's the last time she's even talked to Damian Priest? Why is she still painting that on her face?
Question. Is Rhea Ripley just Raw Charlotte? Over, I'm the champion. I'm only going to be in the feud for the championship. I want the championship. I'm always going to be there for the championship. And then when she's not the champion or directly in the title for it, it's just, we're just holding on until we make her champion again. Then we got to find somebody to make her interesting.
There's so much more you can do with Rhea than Charlotte, which is why I'm wrestling than that. Like Charlotte at this point, she's getting, you know, she's advanced in her career at this point, and we've seen what she can do and can't do. Rhea can actually be involved in narrative stuff and make it interesting. And I mean, the Judgment Day stuff was great.
She could, but they don't. They just play the hits with her.
They don't do that enough, but you have other options with her, whereas Charlotte, you couldn't do that with.
Rhea has far more range than Charlotte, but I'm just saying in terms of her.
And then
usage,
I think the way they're deploying her is very similar. I think that they could do more with her. They don't. Charlotte to me is much more of a problem with basically all you can do is airdrop her into main event feuds that no one really gives a shit about because no one wants to hate Charlotte and no one wants to like Charlotte. So no one wants to see Charlotte. Not really.
Here you go, sir.
I am going to talk, I guess, a little bit about this Seth Rollins faction here. I think it's quickly becoming obvious to me that Rollins and Breaker are going to add somebody else. There's going to be a third man. And I think the question is, who's the third man going to be? I think there's a few candidates here. You could be Louis Kaiser, could also be Gunther, or at least two that I would toss out there. But I do think there's a third man. Who do you think it might be?
Ludwig would be good. I may go.
Ludwig and Breaker would be a good team.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think off. See, I'm not as certain of that as you are. Why are you so certain that there's going to be a third man?
I think that the heels are outnumbered by the babyfaces at this point.
I think they might make deals of some kind, you know, like temporary alliances, but I don't see anybody joining full time necessarily. That's the thing. I don't know.
I think WWE typically likes three people. They like to have the singles guy and then they like to have the tag team.
Yeah, but within that, right now, we kind of have We kind of have Heyman as that third guy, even though he's not a wrestler, because you can see the looks and you can see where it's eventually going to become Paul in Braun's ear to turn him on Seth. And I don't know if we need that third guy in there to be kind of a detour, but I get your point. Or they may just recruit a tag team. That could be the way to do that too.
Yeah. I would really like to. I mean, my pick would be Gunther in this faction. Gunther, Rollins, and Breaker, with Heyman kind of behind all of them. Heyman
three alphas in the same stable. I like, but WWE would be terrible with it. That's my only thing.
Yeah.
The answer to your question would. I mean, my first thought was Sammy to take falls for these guys in some way. But I don't know if that's a good answer or not, given his babyface catch right now. Or Owens, even.
Here's the thing. This is why I actually really like Gunther, because you know who this makes the fall guy now? Rollins. And Rollins can go from being the leader to being the weak link. And Heyman starts slowly turning the guys on Rollins, basically saying, you know, maybe Rollins, who is 40, is not the future of this company as he contends.
That's the story they need to tell here, is that Braun's the actual future and that Rollins is just delusional.
And Gunther, Breaker and Gunther are the actual future of the company. And because Gunther's he's 34, 35?
Yeah, I would love Ludwig Kaiser to get a higher profile somehow, although my fear is if he joins the stable, he becomes the fall guy.
Becomes the fall guy. So, no, that's why I was really kicking this around. I'm like, we keep seeing Gunther on the periphery of the bloodline stuff, and now you have this sort of, like, unbloodline faction of Rollins, Breaker, and Gunther would really like fit in as a Paul Heyman guy. Like I think Heyman and Gunther would actually have some fun repartee. A little bit of humor, like dark humor from them.
Yeah, but that's my fear too. Did you hear the Gunther jokes that Heyman told from the roast or hear about them?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was a great practice for him to know what not to fucking, not to say. Don Rickles called. He still wants some of those jokes back.
Yes, very true. You know, my father was at Auschwitz. He fell out of a guard tower. Ba-dum-bum. You know, those types of jokes. Boy, NXT. Other than the Trick Williams, Joe Hendry, and there was another promo. Oh, the Miles Bourne.
Yeah, yeah.
But the rest of the promos sucked. And suck diddly ucked. Not just bad for NXT, just bad in general. Thank you, Leaf Blower, coming on my way. This women's division, again, we talked about it last week, but their vignettes are just turn the channel where the LFG promo, where they basically bring in Lash Legend. And it was Izzy Dame and company coming in to just bury the new kids who nobody even knows.
I know that's a spot where I'm like, who benefits by these interactions? Is it the NXT people who are like stuck in mid-card hell in NXT? And if you're Lash Legend, like, you've been hanging out there for a minute now, girl. It's time to get a move on. And then you have the new girls and like, Izzy Dame and all these people were kind of like, yeah, you're not taking our spot, Nikita Lyons. And I don't know. I'm not excited about the match potentially between any of them, and I'm not really sure who would benefit from that match.
Yeah, but every successive promo of talk, I just want people to talk. Like, I don't need community theater, and this is where people turn on this type of show for me, but it's like I can sometimes excuse camp. What I can't excuse is friends talking to each other like they've never met each other before, or people being in situations that are going to make them uncomfortable and staying there and not leaving. You know, there's certain things. You know, I'm just doing this because this is a pro wrestling vignette, and this is how we're going to add. This is how WWE does things. Drives me up the damn wall. And this week was just one of those things where I'm just like, anything that's you know, not those two segments. I just hate it. Now, I like Hendry had, I thought, was a great promo about Trick Williams. I don't know if it helped Trick any, because he was basically right in everything that Joe Hendry said, where it's like, there's nowhere for you to go. So it's basically forcing the issue that Trick Williams is going to be your TNA world champion, I think. Would be interesting if he lost.
Yeah, I mean,
to see how they rebuild him, at least from my perspective, not from Trick's perspective, I would assume.
No, I mean, if anything, him beating Hendry, and look, I've talked about the woes of Dark State. Some people asked me about the fourth member of Dark State. It has been brought to my attention that they have four members. I'm very excited to report that this week on Shake Them Ropes, breaking exclusive. There are four members of Dark State, not just Pants Guy, the other guy, Osiris, and then the third guy in that match. There's a fourth guy. I didn't talk about him last week because he was standing outside of the ring saying stuff and didn't really do anything. And apparently he's good at promos, but how can someone apparently be good at promos if they never actually give any promos? It's unclear to me, like, what utility that has. It's like saying a guy has an incredible ephus. That's a pitch in baseball, but if they're never allowed to do the ephus, then what is the point of the ephus pitcher, I might ask you. So I think what needs to happen with Dark State, and led by their valiant leader, the slapjack of the group, I consider Pants Guy. Pants Guy and his ensemble need to join up with Trick Williams and do some sort of invasion angle over on TNA. I mean, no one's going to really watch. I don't know how many people are watching TNA, but at least it'll give those Dark State guys something to do and maybe some people to beat.
And then reveal Rosemary as the lead of the faction, because she's awesome. Love her.
I mean, right? Like, or maybe that Rosemary's brainwashed Trick Williams, but like, I would have Trick, I would have Trick like basically lead Dark State. I think this match with Hendry has to be his coming out party for turning heel.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not going to be, I'm a badass and I've turned heel. It's, oh, I took a shortcut and I got the belt, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah,
it's not the right kind of heel heat. I'll let you go next. Go ahead.
This NXT show for me, just garbage. Like, look, how many different times are we gonna turn Tatum Paxley? You know.
That's the note I wanted. Let me break in here real quick, because I didn't write down all the notes I said. I remember I put this on Twitter, and this is. This is the thing that ticked me off most about NXT this week. You cannot do that Tatum Paxley promo on television and not explain that both Shotzi and Gigi Dolan have been let go by the company. You can't just assume we know these things, or that we'll figure them out, or that every... You can't be Tony Khan and think that everybody watches everything and reads everything on the internet. Why are all her friends gone? Why is she all alone right now? Television show that is not going to explain that because it makes the company look bad?
I would, one, not really touch this. Two, insofar as there's this energy in the crowd centered around the idea, like, oh, you know, Tatum doesn't have her partners anymore or whatever, I would use that to rally babyface energy and sympathy around her. Going into a heel turn following this setup is the exact wrong move. Mm-hmm. I would have had not Thea Hale, but instead a heel come and basically say, you got no friends, Tatum. You suck. Maybe Izzy Dame basically kind of picking up on the Josh Briggs thing. Maybe you could even strike up a friendship between Briggs and Paxley, because they're both kind of on a similar narrative arc right now. But basically,
let's go, like, with the Occam's razor. You're exactly right. Oh, your friends were fired and you're upset, so you're the bad guy now.
Right. It's the Briggs story. Briggs is like, no, you're not. Like, you know, and basically, you know, like, kind of sees a weird, strange friend in Tatum Paxley, the crazy girl, and, you know, basically, you know, starts being like kind of like a friend tour to her, you know, kind of like what he's been doing. And, you know, then she can start being a baby face. You can still keep, you know, some of the crazy affect on her, if you will, the eccentric affect, if you will.
Actually, now I need to rant on that other terrible promo, is the Fatal Influence Jordynne Grace Stephanie Vaquer promo.
Oh my God, that promo, that ass.
And I hate to say that because I love everybody involved in that promo, but man, JC and Fallon, no Jasmine Nix this week. But them
is Jasmine Nix cut or what?
I don't think so, but I don't know what's going on there. Maybe she was just dropped from the act. But it's one of those things where I'm just like bickering while trying to give the promo and doing the passive aggressive thing. No buys for me. Jordynne and Stephanie, like Stephanie's out there basically burying Jordynne while she's in front of her. I hate everything about that promo.
No, I think it's, I mean, it's a bad promo. It was a very bad promo. I thought Jordynne for her part was, or I'm sorry, Stephanie for her part was given dialogue again. That was a real mouthful for her, and she struggled with that.
And then she went into Spanish, and she got there. I think I was thinking maybe that was her choice. I'm not positive.
No. I mean, if that was her choice, good audible, because I mean, they just continue. I forget what word it was this week. I heard that. I was just like, oh, come on, dude. You're writing a paragraph of dialogue, and you don't look at that word and go like, yeah, that's a bad word for this type.
Looks good on paper, but you need to say it out loud, and you need to let her read it out loud.
Right.
To see if she can do that.
Yeah. Write in her voice. Like, listen in your head. Close your eyes.
Yeah,
and hear her voice, how she says stuff, talk with her, whatever you need to do to get a better handle on what dialogue will allow for and what it won't with Stephanie or EO or whoever it's going to be. I find this really tedious, and I blame this on the writers, not the performers. Fatal Influence or whatever the hell they are now, Fatal Attraction, Fatal Influence, I think that story, especially if it's just the two of them, really only works if we are finally setting up for real and for good, because they've teased it once and they can't tease it again, turning JC Jane actually babyface and kind of making her like the long timer that the NXTs know that they rally behind as like,
oh, she's turning heel.
I know. But like the thing is, neither Fallon, like, Fallon has not really done a lot of heelish stuff in her heel run.
Right.
And JC Jane has been a heel for like 5 years at this point, it feels like.
Yeah, no, that's true. We haven't seen her as a baby face.
Except
kind of in that Chase U run.
Right. Right.
Kind of, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Except in that Chase U run a little bit. But like, even that was always like, it was like she was the bad girl in the good group or whatever. But yeah, I think you've got to go. Like, I mean, you need to do something completely different between Fallon and JC, and that needs to be told independent of this. That needed to be told independent of this Omni feud. They don't both need to be in this match right now, because we need to actually see them really falling apart as people.
I'm going to hit AEW now real quick. Look, I liked the FTR segment a lot. It was good basic pro wrestling shtick of trying to get the announcer out to do a match. Stokely Hathaway, other than the Al Bundy comment, which apparently a lot of people don't know who Al Bundy is, who are like 30 and younger. No clue who that guy is. Don't get the reference, at least according to the Fight Game Media Discord.
I can see married with children not necessarily having a lot of appeal to the younger generation.
Right, yeah. That said, no one cares about Daniel Garcia. Can I say that?
Nope.
And not get buried. He held what was thought of as your number two title, and he's out there and he's getting crickets from this crowd because nobody cares. He's a good wrestler. He doesn't even dance anymore. He has no connection with these fans. Beating him up's not going to get any sympathy. Because there's no ceil. I mean, he's past his ceiling already. So FTR beating the crap out of him is like Daddy Magic has more resonance when he comes out and makes a save with a crowbar than Daniel Garcia does within this thing. And also, quite frankly, the team that they want to see, and maybe they'll do this last second next week, which is why I was going to ask you, there's no rumor of this yet, but the thing they want to see is Nigel being forced to team with Bryan Danielson.
Well, I said this last week on the show. I went on a big rant about this a week ago. So, you know, feel free to send to P.O. Box, Chris Novembrino in Albuquerque, New Mexico, all the flowers you want to throw here. But this is obviously the match. I don't think anyone cares about Daniel Garcia. And I think this is perhaps the byproduct of having too many workhorse matches for too long, for 5 years, and having a company that's really built on building blocks of workhorse matches, is that eventually you get to a point where workhorse matches have reduced dividends for each workhorse performing in the workhorse match. And now Daniel Garcia does not have enough workhorse matches or enough workhorses to have workhorse matches with to get himself back to where he was before you made him the Dancing Man. The Dancing Man was the original sin here. Let's not forget that. Like, he doesn't even dance anymore.
It's allowing Chris Jericho to have him instead of the Blackpool Combat Club was the original sin.
Like, right? Yes. No, like, you know, when we talk about the Jericho Vortex, which he likes to joke about, I don't know that Daniel Garcia finds it so damn funny.
Yeah. Your turn, sir.
I had that same sort of like, ho-hum, let's just get to Nigel. I'm really enjoying what Chad Gable is doing in the first hour extended workhorse matches here. I know they're low stakes. I know they're pointless.
Yeah.
He keeps having good matches in these matches. And like, the match with him and Penta this week was really good for a Penta match. Penta's not,
Penta's got his working boots on to look good for the new employer.
Yeah,
he hasn't yet devolved into the bad habits of, you know, coming into the office and sitting at his computer and just surfing the internet for 8 hours while clocked in.
And Gable's the perfect guy to have him paired with, like, not allow him to just check out. He actually has to do his work. I enjoyed this match yet again. I continue to enjoy Chad Gable working with all the luchadors. I guess have they really just fully abandoned El Gran Americano? Is it now just
no? Yeah. They will bring him out when it's time for heat. They need to back off the bit a little bit, I think, is what they're saying.
Yeah.
Where were these thumbs down shirts that Bobby Lashley was wearing this week, 2 weeks ago, at the AEW shop, so people could have made $1 million off of them? Because that T-shirt was fantastic and now has no usage. I did enjoy MJF being Joe Pesci in Goodfellas the day he's going to get made. I enjoyed that whole shtick. And I'll just do another quick hit here real quick.
How do you see this Hurt Business thing ending?
Based off of
that setup this week here.
With the lawyer?
Well, it's the two beats, right? You have MJF who's trying to screw them already with the lawyer and stuff. And then you also have the prior beat where Shelton Benjamin was setting up that super kick. And clearly, there's not a full commitment to this guy.
Well, I thought that was just a mess with him. I thought that was just not mess with us, the audience.
I don't know. I think that speaks to he's not like us. Like there's some reservation. We're taking him in. But we're also fully prepared to pull the trigger on this guy.
Okay, because I viewed it as kind of like, you know, when you're a kid and you're in the Boy Scouts or whatever, and they're saying, oh, we're going to give you the Purple Penguin tonight, and they're going to make you some people haven't survived the Purple Penguin. Yeah, and you start doing those head games with kids and stuff, but you're really all boys kind of a thing. Because I think the move here is to make MJF a full-fledged member of the Hurt Syndicate for at least a few months and then pull the trigger. Because the lawyer thing, when MVP was taken aback by the lawyer thing, it made me think MVP had plans to screw MJF somehow in a contract. So what I thought originally was that in order to prove his loyalty to the Hurt Syndicate, he's going to have to hurt Mark Sterling next week, his lawyer, for bringing him into the whole thing. I thought originally that MVP was upset because there's going to be a clause in this contract where if MJF wins a singles title, that Bobby Lashley gets the first shot at it.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, then that, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Then like that makes that whole circle around where they're like, oh, we're letting you in, but like before that, everyone's circling around, fist in the hand. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like when you do that, you kind of mean it. Like there's like a little bit of
we still don't know. We still don't know if they're baby faces or heels, because we had, you know, we have them cheering them when they come down. We have MJF getting baby face pops when he wants to join them. And then we have Dustin and Sammy Guevara in a prom suit from 1977 come out. He used to be a pillar. What the hell happened to him?
This company makes stars. I've been told that. I have not seen them, but I keep getting told it.
You know, and Dustin and Sammy are obviously baby faces, and they bring them up against this quote-unquote baby face faction of the Hurt Syndicate. And meanwhile, we also have the Crew doing their shtick back there after, I think, losing to Top Flight 2 weeks in a row, or they beat, I can't remember which, because they're just so interchangeable.
And I gotta tell you, if you're gonna call yourself Action Andretti, you better do something once in a while.
Well, I mean, the thing is here, for me, I want Leo Rush to join the Hurt Syndicate, because he's awesome, and he's that runt who can talk and be just a jerk, and instead they're doing the, hey, Lashley, remember when we were buddies and stuff, as opposed to Leo Rush going, I can kick your ass. Which is what I want out of a heel group and a heel team who are going to get destroyed by the Hurt Syndicate. I want them to be mouthy coming into it, if, you know, whatever. But it's just, it's everything's off on there. And let me finish with this then on my AEW ranting and raving and stuff like that. Look, I liked the opener. I thought the opener was a lot of fun, that tag match. I really liked the Buckshot Lariat Hidden Blade combo to end it. I thought that was kind of cool. And yeah, they built up the can they coexist stuff. I get it. But for people who love AEW but hate WWE, Bill Watts and Fritz Von Erich and any other territory guy in a million years would not allow a segment to end where a babyface comes up, jumps off a cage onto six guys, and have the six guys be so scared they run out of the cage, as opposed to staying in that cage and beating the hell out of Swerve Strickland. I liked the beatdown up until that. I thought it was a little ostentatious to just have Swerve walking down to the cage with his music playing, and oh, I'm just gonna saunter up there and jump off of it. I just, it's one of those things where I'm just like, I want this to be a little bit more serious about the violence, but I realize that the Young Bucks are involved, or so it's one of those things where they're going to be cowardly heels. But the whole point of having six on two in a cage is so that you can be faux brave and beat up those two guys. And it's like, okay, great. But that was straight out of Stanford, I thought. But that's me. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, continuing problem for me with this show is you have all these factions and like a power struggle that isn't happening at the top with the Death Riders and the Bucks, and then theoretically the Don Callis family, who want the same things that the Death Riders have, right? Like, the whole reason you have a Konosuke Takeshita or a Kyle Fletcher, and you keep telling us that this man dressed in neon pink is like the future of professional wrestling, is so that Pepto-Bismol Man can have a match against Jon Moxley. Like that's what we're supposed to be building to. The Hurt Syndicate, they don't have meaningful interactions with the Death Riders, and again, they're only in it for the money. So the Death Rider, I mean, one, they should be sort of baby faces of sorts, be based off of the fact that the Death Riders are such a dominant heel faction, or such a, you know, like a predominantly heel faction. But I just continue to feel really lukewarm, because like the top of the card does not federate together into a story that makes a ton of sense. And Adam Page, for me, and his let's call it a redemption arc. Why the hell not? Well, yeah, that sounds fun. His redemption arc for me kind of is emblematic of this, where he's, you know, kind of just like, well, you know, I did some bad stuff, and I'm sorry about that. And, you know, thanks to the fans. I do appreciate you guys. You guys are always there for me.
Let's go to Vader Club. In honor of Sabu, I gave what I thought was his best singles match.
Pretty darn good singles match, I thought.
Yeah. 30-minute draw. Too Cold Scorpio. A lot of fun in this era. This is he's a couple years removed from ECW. From WCW. He as the kids say, likes the weed, which makes him kind of persona non grata in the two major companies for right now. So ECW is kind of the only people who will take him, and he's able to go to Japan and make some money. I forget how thick and big Too Cold Scorpio is compared to some of the high flyers. Like, that is a guy who can move for his size.
I mean, dude, the moonsault.
Yeah.
The moonsault he does in this match alone, the insane amount of vertical, the athleticism that this guy had. He is very much a weed discrimination story to me, because, like, this guy was so unbelievably talented that, you know, any company very easily could have made him that intercontinental workhorse champion with the right presentation, and just ran quality match after quality match after quality match with quality opponent after quality opponent, and, like, let this guy really connect with the fans, which you would see happen from time to time throughout his career. So, like, this flight of fancy or this imagination in my head is not unrooted in history. Like, this is a thing that did and could and would happen for him when given the opportunity. But, like, just, you know, the way marijuana laws have been in this country, especially back then when it was a full-on prohibition, it's a shame to see this guy's career, you know, not be more, and we don't have more matches right now.
Yeah, and he's now working as a security guard and a convenience store.
That's my thing, right? Like, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to get on my, like, social high horse here, but, like, truly, like, this guy, you look at the work, the quality of the moonsaults, all the high-flying moves, but also the fact that he was a big, powerful dude and could do some really good stuff on the ground as well. This guy should be he should not be working as a security guard. He should be absolutely, like, a touchstone, like an intercontinental champion sort of legend type of guy.
Yes.
That we speak of in that breath, like a Mr. Perfect.
I have to make a phone call, so I'm going to end the show here. You can follow me on X at CrapGame13. You can follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word. I do a show called The Dynamite Show with Paul Fontaine Wednesdays, about 20 minutes after Dynamite goes off the air. He and I go live on YouTube, but it drops in your podcatchers for free the next morning. Chris also has plugs to do right now.
Yeah, check it out. Now's a great time to get subscribed to my Spotify. This summer here, I will be dropping an album. I have 13 songs on the album. There is a cover and a B-side also among the stuff. So, I mean, like, a lot of stuff is going to be coming out. I mean, doing, like, actual singles to support the album and everything like that. It's probably the only time I'm ever going to put out a full-fledged album like this. So get subscribed. I think you'll like it. And if you don't like it, I will give you your money back.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now, you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.